The UCF BOT bargaining team meeting with the UCF UFF bargaining team. It is November 10th, 2021. And our first order of business is to look at the minutes from the last meeting and make sure that they're okay. Brianna, can you put those up or whoever has them?
I don't see them yet. That would be good. There we go.
Okay, there we go.
And I guess the ones we TA'd, we don't have to say anything, right? Because we didn't present any new.
I think it says on number 9, says we tentatively agreed to articles 6, 19, and 21.
Right. Now, you know, there was the one confusion in my mind that did we not, you gave a proposal for Article 23, and then did we not, we also presented a second proposal for 23.
I don't think so. I think we took a very long caucus and you came back and gave us a salary analysis spreadsheet, but I don't remember that we actually got a second proposal.
The last thing I have in my drive is from 10/13.
And that was the one with the 3.5?
Yes.
And it was for 1 year?
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Okay. So that's the last one that you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys came back with this one. Okay, fine.
Yeah,
fine.
We're good.
Okay.
Yes, please. I'm assuming there's no objections to the minutes.
No, they look fine to me.
Okay, thank you.
Are we good, guys?
Yes.
Yep.
I think we're okay. All right, great. Okay. So, you know, in view of the audience, I think audience would probably be most interested in articles 23 and 22. Would that be okay if we present those first?
You can present those.
So maybe we do article 22 first. And then 23, because that would set the stage for it. And so Article 22 is about sabbaticals and like it is. Article 22. So let me see.
While you're pulling up that article, could I interject for a moment?
Sure.
I just wanted to let you know at the start that a couple of the folks on our team have a hard stop at 3:30 today.
Oh, okay.
Just so you know.
Yeah, sure. Actually, I have a meeting too at 3:30. So. I guess it was put in my calendar. All right. Okay. So that's fine. I think we probably will be pretty tired, and then we'll see what we need to do. And okay. So if I may share my screen, I guess I'm allowed to now. And let's see. Let me know if you can see it. So do you see it now?
Yes.
So I think, we're pretty much in agreement on most things except for one critical one. And let me just go slowly. Okay. How does it? Okay. That allows me to do that. Okay. So if I do this, then basically, and Charlie, we did check on items and I think we are fine. So again, we are in agreement here. I'm using the version that you sent and then made a few changes there. So this is also fine. The one about ranked link, this is, we're talking about sabbatical here. And let's see. Okay, so then we have, then I think, there was one, and I'll tell you what we did here. So there was this wording here. This is talking about annual evaluation. And then their time on sabbatical shall be evaluated based on their accomplishments made in light of their sabbatical proposal. And you had any ensuing circumstances. So we modified that to make it clear and saying in light of the sabbatical proposal and any ensuing modifications to it. Okay. I was just basically just clarifying that. Okay. So that's all that we did here. I think I knew that we were in agreement in terms of the sense of it.
Right. And we're good.
And the one here, this was an interesting discussion that we had in our caucus. So here that what I, just for clarification, I wrote an employee must disclose the sources of support. Because that's what is mainly, I mean, you know, I've done this many times now, and sure. I know that it, you know, if I disclose that I'm getting money from Finland, it's not as big a problem. But if I say I'm getting money from China, then they may have to do that. So right. The important thing is not whether you're getting $5 or 5,000, but who's supporting you. And so that was the clarification. So I think in terms of the sabbatical part, we are fine. And as you all know, where we are disagreeing is basically on the PDL. So, and here I just wanted to mention something because it kind of ties in with what has been going on in our minds, because the PDL is really affecting people who are not tenure earning or tenured. It's a faculty who may be instruction faculty, so lecturers, instructors, and other bargaining unit members who are eligible. And basically what we see in most of the things that we're dealing with is that I don't think I'm wrong to say that these individuals, particularly the instructors and lecturers, not only do not have a more guaranteed employment, but also their salaries are usually low. So the other thing is that the university relies very heavily, you know, when I tell people that I always ask people to guess, how many students do you think we have at UCF? And so far, there are very few who have been able to guess at 72,000. I mean, this is really the largest university in the country. And we rely a lot on instructors and lecturers. And part of what has been going on, and again, I was trying to just recollect, because I've been at UCF now, believe it or not, for 15 years. And I think we have made amazing strides, right? You would be surprised when I came, I asked people and they said, we don't know what tier we are. We are tier 3 or tier 4. But we very soon, within, you know, a few years of, not because of me, but because of the hard work of everyone at the university, we became a tier 1 university in very short order and also research intensive, right? So R1 institution. And we wouldn't be there if we did not have a large number of faculty, instructional faculty, non-tenure earning faculty who teach 3 to 4 courses all the time, right? These are part of what I did as a chair was to make sure that when I was a chair, not in the bargaining unit, that these individuals got enough time to do research if they wanted to, professional development if they wanted to, and so on. So I think if we want to continue to be really a top-notch university, which we are and we should continue to be, and get even to greater positions in among universities, it is important that we treat our, you know, professionals, our bargaining unit members here who are not tenured earning, and in the same way. And therefore, this offering of one semester only really becomes problematic. So we would like to keep what was that one semester at full pay and 2 semesters at 75%. We also recognize there are not that many applicants who take advantage of that. And there may be that the majority would like to take only one semester because it's fully paid and then they don't have to get funds from anywhere else. On the other hand, and the other thing I want to make it very clear that I'm very grateful, we all are very grateful that we have that opportunity because we know of universities where this is not offered. Okay, so offering a professional development leave to instructors, lecturers, and all others who are not tenure earning is important, and we are very glad that UCF has it. It would be really helpful and for the morale and for everything else, for all the reasons that I've said, that we keep them at par with sabbaticals. So that removes this distinction. It allows instructors and others, if they want to take advantage of the 1 year, because 1 year they could go and do something professionally. We made it very clear and we have accepted all recommendations, which is true, that's fine. Proposals must articulate how the planned activity relates to and serves the mission and goals of the department, unit, and the college. We totally agree. It has to be with that. So we are fine with that addition. The only thing that we are asking, so the only point that where we are we have the difference is that because we feel that it is very important that we treat our non-tenure earning or tenured faculty the same way as we treat the others. So, and for various other reasons. I'm going to stop, talking about that, but that's the only difference. I think you can check it. I'll send it to you. We don't have any other comment in which we did differ.
Well, I had just a quick question about the other thing, the sources of support thing. Uh-huh. You are understanding that it's when you have a conflict, it can also be a conflict of commitment. So that's not necessarily a source of support. But if they're doing another job, for instance, or they pick up an adjuncting job somewhere, that would also be a conflict. And I think that's why we didn't try to break it up into sources of support, like money. It's not only money, it's also conflict of time. Is that understood?
I think that's understood. We can make that. I mean, that's always... But it won't be a conflict of time if you're on sabbatical.
It absolutely can be, though. You can't, I'm not sure how to explain that, but you can't be picking up work as an adjunct, for instance.
I understand that. So
if you have a research assignment. So you're
I understand that. I understand that. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I think if you think that is clear that it should all come in that if you have, for example, if you've got a full-time research assignment, right? That's what you're talking about?
A sabbatical is a full-time or a 0.75, I suppose, depending on which type you get assignment. So if you are, I'm not even sure what that is, leading a church group to do missionary work in another country, that would be a conflict of commitment, if not of money. Do you know what I mean? So when it says sources of support, that made me just feel a little bit weird because the language we have just said, it's basically saying all conflicts of interest, of commitment, or of money. And that's why I think it was worded that way. But I mean, as long as it's understood, I'm not objecting, if that makes sense.
It is. I think that's clear. I think if you have taken on a responsibility and then you get paid for some other responsibility, that's, I don't think that was the issue. My issue was that people don't have to be, they have to say where they're going to be funded from.
Okay.
Yeah.
What, just in the interest of time, I'm going to move on.
All right. Well, I would like to just make sure that I understand everything that you've shared with us, and thank you for getting back to us on Article 22. So what I'm hearing is with regard to sabbaticals, with the possible exception of this question about sources of support and whether that's necessary language, we're in agreement on sabbaticals.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And also the sources of support, if that doesn't clarify, I mean, it was written more for clarification than anything, then it's not a problem.
Okay.
And we were fine with your language if you don't,
okay.
You know, that's not a problem.
Thank you. Thank you.
So the sabbatical part, there's no problem. The only difference, only point where we disagree on the PDL part is the length, is the possibility of having a 1 year at 75%.
Yeah, and that still remains an issue for us. We have talked to the provost, for example, about this very issue. And when an instructor elects, now, first of all, we agree with everything you've said about the value of the instructors and the lecturers. It's incredible. They do an enormous amount of work for the institution, and they're very much appreciated. When an instructor or lecturer is gone for an entire year, it places an incredible burden on the unit to cover as many as 8 classes in a year. And that's very, very difficult to do. When a tenure track faculty member who's tenured goes on sabbatical, there are some courses that need to be covered, but not as many. So it's not as big a burden to the unit to cover all those classes. That's really the issue. It's not a question of value and what the time spent on a professional development leave couldn't bring back to the university. That, we understand that. Your points are very well taken. We're in complete agreement on that. The challenge for the university is dealing with the consequences of an employee who has typically taught, say, 8 courses in a year, who's now gone for a year, and how do we cover those 8 courses?
So Chuck, I mean, there could be certain areas which are where the person is teaching something very specialized. The way I would look at it is that actually, if a lecturer is gone for 1 year, it gives the department the opportunity to hire a visiting lecturer for 1 year. And it is easier to find someone who would come for a whole year than someone who would come for one semester. So there's a counter argument. I also agree with you that, you know, I mean, if some, there may be departments where instructors are teaching a very specialized course that nobody else can teach, that could be different. So I can't speak to every department, but I can only say that in my department, physics, for example, if we get a visiting lecturer, the person would happily come for a year, but would be harder to get for the person for half a year. So that's...
Yeah, and you're right about that. It's easier to get a visitor for an entire academic year. Absolutely the case. But then, you know, one of the things that we talked about was the impact on the unit of having a person who's very critical to the teaching mission of the unit away for an entire year, and you're suggesting we could hire a visitor in their place. That visiting appointment is much more expensive than replacing that person with adjunct faculty, for example, or possibly GTAs. So there certainly are some benefits for the visitor to have that appointment, but what I'm hearing is that I think that would be an additional
strain
on the unit.
So one way out, Chuck, because I would very much like us to resolve these issues, and I haven't discussed this with the caucus, but we could do that. One way out may be to look at how many people really want a full year, you know, and you know, so just and then see. You have also actually from the applications that have come in this year or last year and so on, how many are there that really look for full year? And if it's a very small number, it probably doesn't matter to you. If it's a large number, then we should talk about how we can manage it so that we go halfway or something like that, you know. But again, I'm speaking for myself. I haven't spoken to the caucus yet, but one possibility could be to just look at the number and see if it is really something that is causing a problem, right? So let's look into that. So for example, you know, if we agree on this and then we find out in the next 3 years that this is creating a major problem, we should revisit it. But it could be that there are only a few people. I personally think that a lot of people are interested in going if they get their full salary, because then they don't have to look for any source of support. But there may be others who want that, and that may be not that large a number. So maybe why don't we do a little bit of counting and just see what it is to see if we can, you know, move forward with this with some kind of compromise.
Okay, Talat, do we want to move on to your 23 then?
Yeah, I think let's do that. So let me do that and I can then, okay, I guess I get to share my screen again. So this thing actually will tie in, oh gosh, what's happening? All right, yeah. So I do, actually, you're still seeing my screen, right? So let me, so one thing that I did have, so maybe since I did mention to you, Sherry, about, and maybe I'll stop sharing and let's talk a little bit about this. So our original proposal had asked for multi-year salary raise. One thing that you, so our first question would be, given that it is so late in the year, is it possible, I mean, what we would like to propose is at least a two-year, this year and next year raise. And so that would be one way, then we don't have to be going through this whole, rather, you know, this is an exercise that I think it's hard on all of us. And as you can tell from the number of people, there are 130 people signed up here. This is something which is of major concern. And to be truthful, I think it is major concern to the people who are getting less, salary than others. We have a very broad distribution of salaries. And, for people making, let me just take a number, 150,000 or more, it is probably not as big a concern as it is for people who are making between 50,000 and 100,000, let's say, you know, because, you know, of the dramatic changes that we are seeing in Orlando. I mean, I'm amazed. My nephew was looking for an apartment and I thought, you know, you could get an apartment here easily for, you know, $1,100, $1,200. Apparently that's not the case anymore. And so, you know, house prices have gone up, everything has gone up. So we don't want to go through all those arguments. I'm sure you know that. And the fact that people are coming off of this, we're not still out of it, but basically the pandemic has sort of been very strenuous with the, face-to-face classes, no mask mandate and so on and so forth. I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I'm sure we are in agreement there that, you know, we have when I say we, it's the faculty, the bargaining unit members and everybody else, including everybody here and staff and administrators, everyone has pulled it through so that we have not suffered in any way during the COVID. So people want to see something in their pocketbook. And those who are at the bottom of the salary scales need it more. So that's why my first question to you, Sherry, is that would a two-year agreement be feasible?
No.
So that is it. That's not. And the reason I'm asking you is that we want something to be resolved as soon as possible. This is what we are hearing. And I think they're going to blame both sides. Okay. So we need to really get to some agreement. We already have an offer from you. So it's not like it is zero. So there is an offer. We recognize that. We appreciate that. We need to see what is the justified thing to do. So, okay. So if that is not the case, then as I'm being trained as being to be a bargaining chair, and I was told to bring several things to the table. So I've come with several versions of it.
If you don't ask, you don't get. I understand that.
Right. Okay. All right. So the one so basically that one two-year is not going to go. So we have to basically work with this. So in that case, I think we will make
I can just say, I'm assuming you don't mean take the 2.5% and split it over 2 years, because I think we could agree to do that easily.
We could do that.
I don't think that's what you're looking for. Why
don't we do that to your salary, Charlie?
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't think that's what you're saying, but
that's absolutely
the same
not.
Amount, right? Yeah. So, yeah, okay. That just to be
if,
right.
the, if you want to know what the 2 year would be, then we have already proposed for the second year. And if that is accepted, then we would accept what is in the first year. So basically, if that is not the case, then I say that we essentially then work with what is there. So the other is in terms of what we are going to propose, because there's something I'm going to actually share with you here, my screen, so I'm going back to it. But one of the things that, I think my comment already says that. Sorry about that. I wish we were doing it in person. We should get back to in person. Been too long fiddling around with these screens. Okay, so basically this is the one. And so what we are not asking for much. What we're saying is that why don't we meet in the middle? And we have asked for 3.5 and you have offered 2.5. So we're asking for 3% for those who make above 48,500. And for this is 4.0, by the way. So 4.0, so 1% more for those who make less than that. So that's basically, let me see. Yeah, so this will be 4%. And I can highlight it also. Okay, so that's what we are asking. I will take this out. I didn't know how to do strike through. Maybe you guys know that more better. I didn't know how to strike through this. It would
just right click on it.
I did.
Right click and there's a font.
Oh, I see.
Don't worry about it.
Okay, all right. But basically I said, okay, but what we would like to do, and I'll come back to that. So that is gone. The one that we have is that we just say here, all each eligible employee, and take out this part because this is already covered in article, say here, it's in one of the articles, it already says, I think it is 23.6, which is right below. So basically, so there's no confusion there. If in the CNG or auxiliaries, if there is money, then they will get it. I think that covers it. So we didn't have to have it here and here have, and again, for being more inclusive.
We had that problem before. It has to say ENG because auxiliary employees are not included in that necessarily. So that's why that's there.
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
So the president's email giving everybody else raises didn't generalize it by ENG. And we've never had this contract and grants and CNG soft money in this spot in this article before. So
sure. Yeah, you absolutely have. I mean, I pulled it from an old one, but it's that I agree with you that the contract and grant money is there, but when at the top when it's ENG, you have to make sure that we don't confuse the auxiliary in there. Because it's a problem.
Well, it's not a problem because everybody outside of the unit, outside of our bargaining unit in those areas already got their raises.
I think I will look at that more carefully, but we had a problem in the creative school because they didn't have the funding to do the increases and it was a serious problem for them.
But 23.6 says that, right?
No, it doesn't say auxiliary. That was a problem. So we had to give increases to people and they didn't have the funding in those auxiliary units to compensate. I'm just letting you know what the thought process is behind it. We'll respond, of course.
Okay. So maybe, you know, maybe if you can come up with the specific case where, I mean, we totally understand that, you know, if the funding is coming from a source that doesn't have it, then it cannot provide it. But we need to cover it somewhere, but you know, we wanted this language here to be inclusive of everyone there. And then we can.
In John's unit, it's not a problem, but in other auxiliary units where they're closer to the line, it is a severe problem. So that language has to be there.
And if you add that language here, to say it more explicitly, or in 23.6, that would be fine.
Well, what you have crossed out at the very last, the last sentence in that section, if that's restored, okay. I don't know that we have to have it in the first, but we can't have it crossed out both places.
But yeah, so if we make, so I see what you're saying.
Okay, yeah, Talat, you crossed it out both places.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Talat, we can talk about it in caucus.
Yeah. Yeah, we can. I mean, this is.
I just want to make sure you understand our response.
We understand. We understand.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a question of how to put it. Okay.
Right.
So we can do that. So basically, and the one other thing. So basically, this one-time payment, and I think you see my comment over there. So essentially, what we are asking, because the way you calculated your one-time payment, is based on everybody getting an increase on October 15th. Right? So that's how you did the calculation of that one-time payment, because we are not getting retroactive salaries, right? Mm-hmm. So basically the idea is that you calculate from, let's say if this goes into effect, let me say.
Why you left up?
What's that?
Oh, okay.
Jonathan, your mute's not on. Jonathan, Judy.
Okay. So basically, what we're saying is that count, since you're doing accounting, if we're not talking about retroactive, because as Sherry said, that is not allowed by RBOT, right?
Right.
Yeah, it is an internal UCF issue, because in other places they did allow that. But if we count that raise as if it went into effect August 8th, it's not going to be a whole lot of money between the raises of from August 8th to your deadline of October 15th. So basically, it will put a little bit of money in people's pocket in terms of a one-time support. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Why are you calculating from August 8th when the raise went into effect for others in October?
Well, we are not talking about the others. We're just talking about ourselves. Because,
oh, I see.
Yeah. We're just talking about the bargaining unit because our responsibilities are different from that of the others, right? We can only talk about ourselves. So we're just asking that, and you know, there are differences because our duties are different. Our responsibilities are different. So, you know, and I'm not going to get into.
I just wanted to ask why. That's all. Thank you.
It's not worth it, right? We're all valuable members of the society. But certainly, you know, so for example, and I did want, because one of my bargaining team member would be very happy to bring this up, that, you know, when you get 8 days of, holiday during Christmas, which is great, but that doesn't affect instructional faculty because they have to be preparing their classes for next semester. So you know, we work on a different pattern, you know, so there's no reason to argue about, you know, everything being equal there. So that's the only thing here. We have not, right, so that's no problem. Your comment there, we did not include the last, I was using the one that came from you earlier on 22nd of September. So that's the version I've used. You had proposed something about the RIAs that were being allocated to these three colleges, I guess, undergraduate studies and graduate studies and the centers, I think. And there was some reallocation of RIAs. And UFF would prefer to have status quo on that, unless there's a justification for why we're doing it. I mean, we didn't hear why we were doing it. There was a recommendation to have only to reduce the number, but we would prefer at this point to have status quo. So that's it. The other thing that I wanted to say before we close this is that we would like to bring up the issue of compression and equity, not right now. We would like to do it as when we reopen, and this would be one issue, because I think there was this concern with the ADIs, and we're fine. We will take this amount. So again, I couldn't strike it through. So I would we will take it off. Okay. This is on the ADIs, and we will take it off for now. But this is an issue that we will bring up for discussion after we close the full book, because it's very important that we address the issue of compression and equity, and that then affects a large number of our bargaining unit members. So I think, did I cover everything, guys? John, did I miss anything? Joanna, did I miss anything? Anybody?
No, those are the things we discussed. Anything else we can discuss in caucus?
Okay. Kevin, Alphonse, they were all there. Monique, anybody who would like to say anything, add anything to it?
Is it possible to find out about whether or not we can have a response to that prior to the next meeting?
Yes, but I need to make something clear. Even if we agreed on 23 today, that would not mean that the faculty would be getting raises any sooner, because the 23 will not be implemented until the entire contract is agreed to. So whether we agree to this or not, it's not going to speed up your raises unless we get the rest of the contract agreed to.
No, so we understand that, but I think it is important to agree on this, because, you know, I mean, hopefully we will not delay most of, I mean, I think we are getting there. I don't see very many issues that are, holding us apart. So we should be able to do that. But yeah, we understand that everything needs to be agreed. But also it's important that this issue be settled, right?
Well, I could tell you what I believe the answer will be without much question, but I will let you know within 24 hours. I will present this to the provost, and I can tell you, and I will let you know. I'll email you Talat and let you know what his answer is.
Okay, and so my question then would be, I mean, if he agrees, then we're done. If he doesn't agree, is there a chance of when do we meet then for just the salary issue?
Our next meeting is December 1st.
And Sherry, I don't know if you can promise 24 hours because tomorrow's a holiday. Just
That's true.
As soon as practicable, I guess, is the best way.
Friday. How about Friday?
I can give you an answer by Friday.
So if you give me an answer by Friday, could we have a session on the 17th? If he agrees, then we didn't need no session.
On the 17th, just to discuss salary?
Yeah. Or even Friday, Well, we can't do it Friday because we need to have 3-day notice.
Well, if his answer is no, what would we be meeting on the 17th for? For you to present a counter proposal?
Well, I mean, you know, we'll have to work out something so that we can't be going through. I shouldn't use the word impasse because that means different. that's a big word in bargaining language, but. But we would like to move forward on this.
We'll have to talk about that in caucus a lot, because I don't know that I see any advantage to that, since we have so many other things on the table as well. I think we're a long way off right now from reaching agreement on several articles, and I think we're a long way off on this one, but I'll have to get that confirmed by the provost.
So Sherry, would it be possible for you, you can't talk to the provost right now and get an answer?
You mean by the time you want to break?
We go in caucus.
You run down the hall and see if he's available? Is that what you're asking?
Right. That's what I was told. That's how
the schedule already. He's in the meetings with the he can't talk right now. He's double booked right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible I can get an answer before the end of this bargaining session, but I can't guarantee that.
Okay, so why don't you try that? And that would probably be the best thing right now. And then, because as far as we are concerned, you know, we don't want 122 people, coming over at these sessions. And obviously, this is something of great interest. And I love to see them there. I don't want people to get the impression that we don't want them here. But I know that they are taking precious time away from what else they're doing. So the sooner we resolve this, the better off we will be.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay. All right. So I think that was this. And then should I present, or actually you guys
lot of things we need to present. So.
Okay, let me present number 9, because 9 is very simple, I think. Until I present, I guess, I don't know. So 9, the only, there was only one issue that was being holding us back. And I think that can be resolved. So there was this, So I'm basically looking at your proposal. And so the comments I've made right there. So let me just share that quickly. And then I will do, if you want us to do, I can do one more, but I could also.
No, we do not, because you left a lot of stuff on the table for us to respond to last time.
And
we'll
do that.
Those things back on the table.
Perfect. So here's number 9, and I think there was only one point there, and that was this about online office hours.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that we had proposed that we added, so we would just remove this.
Okay. In that case, I think we can TA on 9. But let's get some other things on the table.
Okay, good. So we have basically TA'd 9. So why don't I stop sharing and you guys present?
Okay.
Well, I think I'm going to be doing most of the presentations for our side. And I'm going to ask Charlie to share Article 24. Close enough. We'll work with 28. This is one of the articles that was shared with you by email the other day, Talat. Essentially, what we've done here is taking the status quo language. There are 5 editorial changes that we made that are not showing in this version that we see, because this is the PDF, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
There were 5 places that you had recommended that the article V be struck. And all 5 cases, those have been struck.
We're done with this. Yeah. This looks good.
So am I hearing correctly?
Yes.
We're so good on 28.
We TA, yeah. We TA
this one. On 28. All right. Excellent. Yeah. Thank you. This is Article 24. In Article 24, what we're really proposing are 4 changes. I don't think any of them are very substantive, but we'll go over them. In lines, say, 20 through 24, we're just trying to direct people who are considering retirement to HR to find out what happens in HR, what sort of benefits do they get. What's the nature and extent of the benefits that they get as retirees? So we just want to direct them there. These are things that, to the extent that they are available, they could be enjoy, these benefits could all be enjoyed by a retiree. Down at the bottom of this page, lines 41 through 44, we're suggesting that this be stricken. This actually refers to a statute or what's dictated by statute. It's nothing that we can negotiate. So we think it's just absolutely best if we just strike this language. There's nothing that we can change about it. Anyway, we just go ahead and strike it. Then lines 50 to 55, through the end of July this year, there was the possibility that we would re-implement the phased retirement program. Through the 31st of July, we had not heard from the UFF that you were interested in reopening enrollment for the phased retirement program. So that program is now officially not existent any longer. There are a couple of people that are still in it. They will be allowed to continue and finish out their time in the phased retirement program, but no one else will be entering. And this is no longer an option for employees to choose the phased retirement program. As a consequence of striking that section 24.6 for the phased retirement program, there are some numbering changes of these sections. And then the last change I want to point out is on line 112. We tried to follow your lead, where it tried to spell out 9 and 12 rather frequently instead of using the numerals. And that's what we've done here, is just replace the number 12 with the word 12. And that's what we're proposing for Article 24.
Charlie, this phased retirement thing, I think it came in the discussion before I was part of this bargaining team. So
that had been around for quite a while.
I see.
That was here over 20 years ago when I arrived.
Uh-huh.
And it was not a particularly popular program. There were a few people that dissipated. And then about, I think, two books ago, we tried to, at the suggestion of the UFF, we tried to make it a little bit more attractive, clean some of the language that had been up in there for some time up, but we didn't see a big return of interest in that particular program. And as a consequence, a couple of years ago, we proposed the Transition to Retirement Program, the T2RP, which is getting a much, much better response from in-unit employees. There are quite a few people that are already participating in that program. Many more people are participating in the T2RP program than are currently in the phased retirement. I believe there are two people that are still in the phased retirement program.
Yep, Talat, I can speak to this program.
Go ahead.
It was during the last full book, the 2018 to 2021 full book, that we initiated this, and Chuck is correct that we asked for a replacement program, and that's how the transition to retirement came about.
Okay.
And we said that we would revisit this in the next full book, and so far we haven't heard of any problems in this this program. So that's okay with the phased retirement program, because it's not as useful as it used to be. The legislature has made a lot of changes to phased retirement that doesn't make it as much of a benefit to our employees anymore.
Okay.
I did have a question. Charlie, could you scroll back up to the first change talking about the retirement benefits? So we have a listing of retirement benefits in the contract. So I'm just curious of why we need this additional language.
Well, we want to encourage everybody who's contemplating retirement to talk to HR and make sure that they understand exactly what they're getting into. It's a big decision for anybody to make, and that's where we would recommend that they go. So that they understand exactly what is going to happen to them, because they have all the information. information on the benefits can change from year to year. Folks need to talk to HR about this. Want to make that very clear.
So Charlie, would it be possible, just because we said you had to receive the following benefits at the university, we could then enumerate as we have, and then right at the end of it, say what you have added there, just say retiree benefit information, just a sentence after the listing of everything, because then, and not right there. In other words, the list is already there, and then we can say they're encouraged to contact HR and so on. So we could say just
put it in the header because it applies to everything. Is that what you're saying? Just right there?
Well, I'm saying either there.
It's moving it there is fine. I just want to make sure that people know, because there's ORP, FRS, investment plan, and everything depends. And so you really want to direct people to HR to talk to them.
Why don't we say, in fact, I wouldn't say, I wasn't planning on putting it there. I was going to say, or we could say that, you know, why don't we come back with we could have TA'd it today. So let's do it. So we can caucus if we need to. But I think what you want to say is exactly what you and Chuck just said, that, employees are encouraged to contact HR because they can actually, you're right, they can find out more information, but then we list what it is. So we can.
And that's fine. I will leave this as our proposal with that in the different place. It didn't matter. Okay. I should have seen that to start with. That's fine. That's great.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a lot. We can talk about this in caucus.
Okay. I mean, that would be out, but we agree with what you're saying.
Okay, great. So did you want to move to the next one?
Yeah, and this one we would definitely TA today.
Understood. That's fantastic. Chuck, did you want Article 10, is it?
17 is next.
17, yes, sir. Okay.
You know, we've talked about this article, I think, a couple of times before. There's some places where I think we've got agreement that we could finalize right now. I think there are a couple of places where we have some substantive issues to still address. I think there's three of those. But for example, this cleanup on line 32, it's a simple change to make sure that we cover all the cases. It isn't just whether somebody has less than 160 hours or more than 160. What happens if they have exactly 160 hours? And we just want to make sure that that's covered. I hope that seems very reasonable.
Fine. That should be fine.
Okay. And then we had removed faculty excellence, replaced it by academic affairs. Sometimes names of units change from time to time. It's always going to be under academic affairs. It'll always be under the provost's office. We think that's clear. There are a couple of instances in lines 43 and 45 where we say
not
less than.
Did you want to respond to that? I was just going to go okay or not okay as you went through.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And then on 43 and 45, there are two instances where we say not less than. We're suggesting that it might be better just to replace that with at least.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Okay.
That's fine.
Thank you very much. And then on line 55, I believe we had talked about this before. It isn't just days that people have to claim on sick leave. Sometimes it's hours that we're looking at. We just wanted to make that clear.
Right.
Is that
right?
That's good?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And then we had also talked about indicating not just scheduled time, but scheduled duty is something that we wanted to recognize. An employee needs to report sick leave when any scheduled time or duty is going to be missed.
Okay, so if the right to you mean to report to one's supervisor?
Correct.
The status quo says scheduled time, and we just was like your duty, if you're missing a duty such as these things.
I don't think we're going to agree to that, right? We have to think about that, because typically the what we report is which class we're going to be missing. Okay. If I have an appointment with my graduate student and I get sick, I don't see the need to report that to my supervisor because...
I don't know that it's reporting to your supervisor, Talat. I think we misspoke on that. I think it's, we have to, I know faculty don't typically fill out LAPERS. I guess they, the department secretary or somebody does that for faculty. The rest of us actually have to hand write them in ourselves. But the idea is if you're going to miss, if you're going to be gone because you miss a class or office hours or something, you just have to report that on the time sheet, whatever, however you want to describe it, as taking sick leave for that period of time.
Yeah. So what I'm saying, Sherry, is that for a faculty member, I mean, for instruction, when I'm talking about, again, you know, people who do research and teaching, right? The teaching is something, classroom is something that we have to report because that is something that cannot be missed, right? Right. And office, or but all other things, we readjust. You know, so if I am committee chair and I have got a committee meeting, I will make that arrangement. So, you know, what we're saying here is now everyone has to report everything and we don't have, you know, that's not how we do things. We rearrange them. And who do I, should I be then reporting what I'm rearranging? That's the problem. I totally agree that we will report everything that has to do with the classroom instructions because they have to be taken care of.
But I'm glad to see from the chat that a lot of faculty fill out their own. I think it was the UFF president who told me that in history, they don't necessarily do it. The idea was to clarify that it's scheduled time that's the status quo language. I just wanted to make sure you knew. If you want to think about that, that's fine. We can
we'll think about it and
not a big deal.
Okay. And this is something that we had talked about before when employees are out on approved sick leave in order to return to work, they have to provide medical certification that says they're able to return to work. I know we've talked about that before. Yeah. I don't know, Talat, is this something that's acceptable?
I think it was. We can, when we go into caucus, I can ask people, but I think there was not a problem there.
Okay.
Talat, it was just briefly, just to tell Chuck, there were the medical certification, and it might be just because it's COVID times, and we were discussing this because some people couldn't even get like a medical appointment because of COVID and stuff, and it was such a backup. So say somebody was ready to work and they wanted to go, but they couldn't get that medical certification because, you know, there's a and that happened to me as well, a 3-month backup at the doctor's office, and urgent care was full because I had too many. And this was back in September and October. So I think when we were discussing this at that time period, we were at the heat of Delta. So right. Yeah, but we'll take a look during caucus.
Yeah, thank you, Giovanna, for reminding us about that. It also says in here that, you know, this would be an issue if no updates had been provided. So if somebody's, I actually had a situation a year ago where we had a faculty member who just wouldn't provide an update. I mean, tell us that you called the doctor and that you tried to schedule an appointment. No, I don't have time to do that. That doesn't work. So we understand that there may be unusual circumstances. I certainly hope the worst is over for us with COVID. But what we're asking, we need to hear from people. We need to know what's going on. So that the university can plan, you know, are there classes that have to be covered? Do we have to change somebody else's assignment? We just need to know what's going on. But thank you for reminding us about that. And this was one of the substantive changes that we had proposed, that employees hired after the ratification date of this agreement would not be entitled to a sick leave payout after 10 years of service. And, you know, we're saying that we understand that's a substantial proposal from us.
Right.
And this is, basically point two, it's the same thing. We're on line 122. There's some language there that is outdated. It actually appears here, and it affects a statement a little bit later on this page. It's just simply outdated language, and it's caused some confusion, and we are suggesting it be stricken. Lines 126 to 130 is also some legacy language that just is not used about these employees who are coming back and being reemployed, and how they can return all the sick leave payout and have their sick leave restored. It's legacy language. It just simply does not happen. And then Charlie has highlighted some language on 134 to 136 that's related to the point on 122. This is some language that's just caused confusion for people. It makes them think, if I have a disability, I can stay on the job until all my sick leave is exhausted. And that's not the case. If somebody's truly got a disability, they're not able to work, they should be retiring or whatever to be separated from the institution. We're striking thing about the return of the lump sum payment. That's related to the striking of 126 to 130. And then there is a payout of sick leave in the event of the death of an employee. There is a payout of sick leave to the employee's beneficiary, and we're making sure that it's understood that it's subject to the same limitations that apply to employees. It's 25% of the unused sick leave to a maximum of 480 hours. And then we'll try to do a little cleanup on line 177, 186 and 187. Also just trying to clarify what's meant by part-time. We don't want to say that a nine-month employee is part-time. While the nine-month employee is under contract, they would typically have an FTE of 1.0. So rather than talking about the percent of time employed, we're talking about the FTE while they're under contract.
Okay.
And we think that's, Talat, do you agree that that might be something that's clarifying?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we wanted to make something clear. There appeared to be some confusion that if someone had an addition to their family and on the first occurrence used the modified instructional duties, that they were then ineligible in the future for another addition to the family. They would not be able to take paid parental leave. And we want to make that very clear, that they are, that if somebody takes modified instructional duties with the first addition to a family, with the subsequent addition, they could take the paid parental leave option if that was something they were interested in doing.
Okay.
So again, we're hoping that's helpful.
Yep.
And then this is another thing that that we're changing that I think looks more substantial than it is. On line 279, for 12-month non-instructional research and clinical employees, instead of 16 contiguous weeks of paid parental leave, we're requesting that it be changed to 6. And the reason is, these are employees who get annual leave. The paid parental leave was attractive when it was implemented, because many of the nine-month employees do not get, all the nine-month employees get no accrued annual leave. The only things available to them is their sick leave. But for these people that also accrue annual leave, that's a very legitimate use of that annual leave, and we would rather have the paid parental leave, the lengthy paid parental leave, really apply to the nine-month or instructional employees.
So, how much do they get, Chuck, in terms of annual leave? Is it 2 weeks?
Well, they accumulate 6.77 hours every pay period.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually accumulate the annual leave about, it's a little over 150% as fast as they do the sick leave. So they're getting twice as much leave, more than twice as much leave as the 9-month employees are while they're on a 12-month contract. And then the 9 or 12-month instructional employees would get one regular semester. 12-month instructional employees would have the option of taking leave either in the fall or the spring or the summer. They could decide whichever term they wanted, depending upon when the change in the family status occurred. Having the option to do that in the summer might be very attractive to some folks. And then based on a request from an in-unit employee, we're proposing as a trial to say that 9-month instructional faculty could opt for paid parental leave in the summer instead of the spring or fall, which is what would normally be done, if they've got funding, sufficient funding from CNG sources to pay for that leave. This came up because we have a faculty member that is interested in doing it, I believe, this coming summer. And
but do they get paid? I don't understand this.
They would get paid, yes. But they would be paid from the CNG sources. If the CNG account allows it, if their funding agency allows it, we're okay with that.
So their funding agency, but why do they have to get leave? I mean, I don't understand why they have to get leave if they're a 9-month employee. They're not working in the summer anyway. Maybe
well,
I'm
this is someone
something.
That has funding for the summer from external sources.
Uh-huh.
Who's saying, you know, my grant will allow this. I would prefer to take my leave in the summer. Because of the timing thing, I just had an addition to my family. This would be the ideal time to do this. I could try to muddle through for the summer and then take it in the fall, take my paid parental leave in the fall, but I'd really rather do it in the summer and I can cover it.
It's okay. I mean, it's
a request from one of your.
Yeah, I understand. It's fine. I'm just wondering, it doesn't affect other, I mean, if it can be done, then it can be done. Right.
So like, can I clarify something? So
yeah.
Chuck, you said that a member of our bargaining unit came to the administration and requested this in your proposal?
No, they requested the opportunity to do this very thing. And we want to put it in here and say, well, if it would be okay for one person, let's make it available to everybody.
No, what I was wondering is what was stopping them from doing this, right? There's nothing that stops them, but you're saying that we should highlight it in case they want to do it. Because, you know, if you're not working in this.
Because your 9 months cannot get the summer. 9-month people can't get the summer.
No, I understand. So you know, like.
They weren't allowed to do it.
Yeah. Okay. I think
maybe there'll only be one person.
It's not a big
they
deal.
Want to do this.
It's not a big deal. It's we can. So this is for parental leave. Okay, we'll talk it over.
Okay.
It's not something that will stop us from agreeing on this. Thing. It's fine. It's just clarity that I needed.
Yeah, line 438 is the same kind of thing that we had before, time and duties.
So is there a form in which these duties need to be filled out? So I think you might want to just tell me before we go break for caucus. So there is a form in which we say when we are going to be sick and what schedule duties we are going to miss. Is that what you're saying?
Well, on the LIPR form, you normally indicate the time.
Right.
But there's a section where you also indicate the reason.
Right.
So, you know, it could be I missed a class, for example. And one of the things that we did on our, it was on our last full book, was to introduce this idea of recovery leave. We had something in there before called compulsory leave, and we wanted to make this a much more positive thing for the employees. This is really seen as something to help them get back to good health. The way we structured this, it was kind of confusing in the CBA, and we're hoping that with a couple of title changes for sections here, that we can clear that up. In order to determine whether someone should be on recovery leave, we need to do an assessment. Sometimes that's instituted by or initiated by the employee. Sometimes it's done by the employer, but there has to be an assessment of the fitness to duty. And then if it's determined that somebody is really not able to complete all the customary functions in their position, they may be placed on recovery leave. But we wanted to make it very clear, whereas before it just called this entire section recovery leave, the first step is really to do this assessment of the fitness for duty of the employee. And if it's determined that recovery leave is appropriate, then we go into talk about recovery leave and the conditions for recovery leave and the duration of recovery leave. And Talat, at one point you had, I believe, raised some questions about this notion of fitness for duty.
Right.
And we've looked at this. This is what it's called. This is the term that's it's used to determine whether someone is really able to continue to perform the necessary functions of their
job. So basically you're changing the title there of this.
Well, you had asked about the fitness for duty words.
Yeah.
But that's a standard way to refer to this type of assessment. We just want to make sure that it's clear in here that this entire section isn't about recovery leave. The first step is determining whether recovery leave is appropriate, whether the person really is not able to continue to perform all the necessary functions of their job.
Okay, we'll take a look at this. We'll take a look at that.
Okay, Chuck. Do you have any more questions, Talat? Do you need me to scroll to any other section?
I think we're fine. Just one clarification that I just needed to have because of the duty part that with sick leave. So supposing somebody misses a class, is sick, misses a class, is that individual's responsibility to find a replacement to take that class? Because that's what typically does happens. But is it that, or is it then? They reported they're sick, then it is the responsibility of the chair or whoever does the assignments to find someone to take the class.
Well, I think the thing that the employee has to do is notify the supervisor that they're going to miss duties.
And then the supervisor.
I think it could be up to the employee and the supervisor to determine
who will do it,
who's going to cover the class, as long as it's somebody that is acceptable.
Yeah. Okay.
And certainly I know there are times when I've missed classes and a colleague in my department might cover for me. And at some point they might be sick and I cover a class for them.
Right,
that certainly happens. But regardless of what sort of arrangements are made, the supervisor needs to know about it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Just wanted to get that clarification. Yeah. Okay.
All right, what next, boss?
Okay, what's...
Want to do another one?
Which is next? Which one do you have next?
10, please.
Okay.
We think 1 and 3 and 31 are easy to handle. Famous last words.
Okay, so here's Article 10. And we think that it's only in Section 10.2A where we're really still having anything to discuss. And this is also related to something in Article 14 that we could share with you next.
Okay.
And in Article 10, particularly 10.2, Charlie, this is looks like it's on line 210. It says in here that employees eligible for promotion to professor shall be similarly apprised of their progress toward promotion at least once prior to submitting their promotion dossier. So it's under the section about CPE. Mm-hmm. And Article 10 has said
that
it is incumbent upon candidates for promotion to full professor to seek at least one CPE prior to submitting their dossier. Mm-hmm. It doesn't specify when it is. It just says it has to be done at least once and has to be done prior to submitting the dossier.
So it's already in PDF format.
And there's language that we proposed in 14 that we will share with you again.
That makes
what's said in 14 consistent with what's...
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, and then Charlie, on 255, this is something else where we've not agreed yet. The status quo language is that at the end of 3 years of tenure or post-promotion service, in every three-year period after that, there's a sustained performance evaluation. You've
and
proposed,
this is the one that used to be 7.
Yeah, at one time it was 7. It is
and
three
we have a list of what it is at other SUS campuses.
Our preference is for the status quo language and keeping it at 3.
Yeah, that's the one that we definitely differ on.
Sherry, did you want to say anything about where the legislators are on post-tenure?
Well, I mean, I think that one of the reasons why we would like to keep it here is because we think there's a concerted effort in Florida to implement much more rigorous sustained performance evaluations. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure at least some members of your unit, I know Robert
Casanello
actually commented on it in the newspaper, there's a very somewhat draconian proposal floating around the legislature right now that would essentially turn, right now it's kind of up to the university to prove that somebody isn't performing well after a certain period of time that they get tenure. If this legislation goes through, and it has in a number of states, it flips that and says basically it's up to the employee to prove that they should remain employed. So I think we're trying to show the powers that be that we are serious about sustained performance evaluations without implementing some of the more draconian provisions that are being floated around. And even more important than that, getting rid of tenure altogether. So, but, you know, that's...
So, yeah. So what I understand, Sherry, is that it is the Speaker of the House who has mentioned to his colleagues, but there is no bill that is there.
There's no bill yet. There are proposals that are floating around, and there are various drafts of things that they're looking at, all of which are very similar to the things that have passed in Georgia and South Carolina and Texas, our fellow red states.
So the point is that, you know, when you work with faculty and you're talking here about somebody being evaluated every 3 years, I guess we are talking about people who are below satisfactory, right? People who get conditional or unsatisfactory. That those are the only two we're talking about, right? Because if that is not the case, so and as long as they are anywhere up to satisfactory, then it doesn't matter. So we're talking about what happens if you get an unsatisfactory or conditional. Then the question is 3 years a period in which people can recover from one to the other? Or you know, usually we take one could be, for example, one could have been doing above satisfactory or even outstanding for 2 years, and then all of a sudden gets below satisfactory because whatever chart or whatever the department chair is using, because then some chairs do that, he or she did not get a publication that year, right? And so unless you do it over a period of time, a period of 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, it's rather skewed. So I'm not sure what we are trying to achieve by putting ourselves in this situation. Because
we're not looking at 1 year to what we're saying, the average over the 3 years. So if you have a bad year, you're not going to be, let's say you've been outstanding for 2 years and you sort of, you know, have a tough year and you've slipped down to, say, conditional, that's not going to tank you for the period. You will work with develop a performance improvement plan and have, I think it's 2 years to implement that performance improvement plan. So we're not saying that you have a bad year and you're gone.
Right. Okay. We'll take a look at it again. I know that there's a strong sense in my team to keep it at 7 years, but
be going back to 7 years because currently it's at three.
Right.
There's also a proposal from the UFF to have the employee work with the supervisor and look at the expectations for satisfactory performance and to make that sort of the standard for any kind of performance improvement plan. And we're of the view that the AESP really isn't a target. It's a tool that's used to evaluate the performance over a single year. When we're looking at trying to have someone truly improve their performance, hitting the standards for satisfactory in the AESP is probably not ambitious enough, and that they can be expected to do a little bit more and really to do something that's tailored to the work that they're expected to do. Some people it may be to improve on teaching, some people it may be to improve on research. So we think that developing a personalized performance improvement plan based on the circumstances of the employee is much better for them and for the institution than just saying, we want you to be able to hit the satisfactory level.
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is that the department chair doesn't know what the strengths of the individual faculty member are. We are not just teachers, you know, we are basically researchers, most of what we were talking about, right? I mean, we're talking about annual evaluation, and again, I'm going to get myself in trouble here but I better distinguish that we have got, you know, faculty who are tenure or tenure earning, and for them, research is a major part of their portfolio. Then we've got faculty who are instructional, for them, it's mainly teaching. And then we have got faculty who've got other responsibilities, right? So if you have faculty who have other responsibilities where you're basically responding to a unit head who tells you exactly what to be doing, I guess the unit head can make that plan. But if you're talking about a faculty member who is doing creative activities, how would the department chair make a plan without knowing what the person is capable of doing, rather than just saying that, look, I want you to publish so many or whatever, you know, you have to do that. Well, I mean, you can then decide that instead of, if number of publications is what the chair wants, okay, I'm going to go and publish, you know, an article that may not mean anything. So I'm not sure how, you know, we are not, you know, I mean, we don't work by the hour, right? I mean, so I'm not sure how you can control or promote the in creative activities of a faculty member without involving that faculty member in that decision-making process. It just seems very, very alienating to me to think that you're going to be, you know, and even with instruction, right? I mean, people have to get on board, there has to be something, they have to provide some input as to why they are doing what they're doing, because I think every faculty member in a university, in a major R1 university, is really doing the best to his or her ability, right? Of course, there may be room for improvement, but you have to engage the person in there if you're going to help the person improve. You can't just tell that, I want you to create this in 1 year. If you can't create this, then it just doesn't happen. I just don't think there's any thinking going on here that we are dealing with people whose job is creativity, whose job is mentoring, whose job is basically, you know, not a run-of-the-mill production. So I find that very difficult that, you know, somebody will just tell me that you will do better if you just did this.
It's a lot. Yeah. Would it make a difference if we said that the performance improvement plan shall be developed by the department chair or unit head in consultation with the faculty member?
That's exactly what we had recommended. Those are the very words we had said. Okay. In our proposal, we said in consultation with the faculty member. That's all we said. And that's fine.
My only objection is that you're looking at the supervisor knows what satisfactory performance is, and that bar is usually pretty low to get to just satisfactory. Other things are more difficult to reach, but satisfactory isn't usually so difficult. So,
but yeah, what Sherry had suggested here, which I think might be a way for us to solve this, is, you know, performance improvement plan shall be developed by the department chair, unit head, in consultation with the employee.
That was in our proposal, Charlie.
But
it's right there, Chuck, on the side.
I see that, Charlie, but that's not what Sherry said. That Sherry didn't include all of the highlighted language. There was nothing about alignment with the expectation of
science. I see.
Well, so, you know, I'm actually in agreement with Sherry that if we did that, the thing is that we can leave out the other part, you know, that and if we add in what Sherry has said, and again, we're going to discuss this in caucus. I think what we are trying to do, and I agree with you, Charlie, as a chair, your goal is never to make a person perform at the satisfactory level. Your goal is always to create the situation so the person can perform at the outstanding level. You know, and so that's not the issue. But the point is that, you know, we're talking about firing somebody and we're talking about you know, because of this 3-year thing that you've put here. So I think there's some things that have to be brought into the discussion here about what is this about. If it is about excellence, then of course you're going to try to make every faculty member live up to outstanding standards. But if you're talking about somebody who's going to be fired unless they did such and such, so you can't just go from conditional to outstanding in a 2-year period. You may, but you may not. But the main thing is that you don't want the person to jeopardize the person's career just because he or she had a few, 2 or 3 years that were not productive. So again, this is it's a question of what we are trying to do here.
Looks like that's it for 10, Chuck.
That's it for 10.
Okay. I think we can talk it over and then get back to that. I think we can converge on this, and there may be a couple of points that need to be clarified further.
Yeah, I think we need to have that language. I mean, I have to say, I would be, if I were in a situation where an employer wanted to put me on a performance improvement plan, it would only be I would be very upset if I didn't have an opportunity to weigh in on that and what those goals should be. Yeah. And I'm undercutting my team here, I suppose, but.
Where do you want to go next? Is it 14?
Yeah, let's do 14.
I'm just looking at my eyeballs on the clock, and I know everyone has a hard stop at 3:30, so.
Yeah, this may be the last one we can do before we caucus.
And you know, Charlie, we could send 1, 3, and 31 to you.
Thank you.
Because they're minor. And then you can, is that allowed?
Sure.
Okay.
Okay, this is Article 14. There are two things that we think we need to resolve. One is in Section 14.2. Just want to make sure that it's understood that these regulations are not subject to the grievance procedure in Article 20. So there's a statement that we've proposed in lines 18 through 20 at the end of that section. The alternative, as far as we're concerned, is just to delete that entire section. If we're going to list the regulations, which we think are helpful to faculty, we need to have this statement just for clarity.
And I will point out that the reason, I mean, we already have language in several places in the contract, and it is also just a matter of law, that we cannot make substantive changes in regulations that are in conflict with the CBA without coming back to the table. But we can make, you know, if we want to change, we want to retitle something or make a small change that is totally non-substantive, we have the right to do that. And we're not going to bargain over whether we call something, I don't know, faculty excellence or faculty relations, which is a stupid example, but I couldn't think of anything off the top of my head any better. But if we, of course, tried to impose something through a regulation that was in contrast to the CBA and didn't bring it back to the table, we would be subject to a ULP. That's the appropriate remedy, not a grievance, but we do have language that already covers that. We just want to make sure that, you know, if we need to change something that is not substantive, that we can do so without a big hassle over it.
So Sherry, what you're worried is that if we didn't include these three lines, then if you went into UCF 3015 mm-hmm. and made a minor change there, but I think once you make a minor change, it doesn't remain 3015, right? It becomes a new number. Is that what happens?
Number stays the same.
Yeah. Okay, so number stays the same, and you made some minor changes to that, and then the person will grieve that.
We've actually had people say to us at the table on your side that we could not change so much as a comma in a current regulation if it's included in the bargaining in the CBA. And that's uh-huh. what we're trying to make clear, that no, we can't be that rigid on this. So that's our whole point, because otherwise we can't, by law, we can't make substantive changes to these things or changes that are contrary to the CBA without bringing it back to the table. And we're not even making any attempt to do that. We wouldn't do that because we don't want to have to defend it because we know we couldn't.
So you are protecting your right to make minor changes in these. Is that the
right? Outcome? Yeah.
So can we not say that explicitly?
We can certainly say that explicitly.
You know, because what we could say is that you know, no substantial changes can be made in these documents without.
Sure, and I can come up with language that would.
That would
be language for though. If we keep this in there, this it just lets you know you don't grieve it through Article 20. It becomes, is that PERC, Sherry?
Yeah.
That's what we wanted to make clear, that if you have an objection, it goes through PERC.
Well, it's not an objection, but you'd be telling if we did something that was contrary to the bargain, if we tried to impose a change that was substantive, that changed the terms and conditions of your employment through a regulation without coming back to the table,
yeah,
then that would be an unfair labor practice.
So why don't we'll have to talk it over and just, you know, maybe and see what kind of clarity we can include
sure.
there. Yeah. This language may not be acceptable, but maybe a, you know, better defined.
Right.
And the last thing we have to show you in Article 14 is language that's very similar to language we've already shown you in Article 10 about the CPE for employees considering promotion to full professor.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, and if we, are we?
Yeah, that's fine. I mean, you know, we'll go for caucus and then. I think.
And I do have an answer from the provost. I did email him with an urgent summary. He says, regarding the salary proposal in terms of the 3% across the board and 4% for the lower paid faculty. And the response was, we can't. We don't have extra money. So that is hot off the press, the provost's response.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks. Thank you for doing that. And then why don't we go for caucus for about 10 minutes? And then
it's fine.
And then we come back. Yeah. Okay. All right.
All right. So we're going to leave and go. You have to stay here, right?
Yeah. Hold on. Give me a second because I have to start this again because
that's okay. Do you want me to stay here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Charlie,
we're trying to make sure we don't
do this, you know. There's a little bit here and there. So in the case of 24, that was the one that I was thinking, 28 is okay, right? We already agreed on that.
Yes.
Yeah, 28 is fine.
And 24 too.
24.
We did not agree on 24 yet.
We didn't agree on 24. If we take out we are happy to take out the stuff on the phased retirement thing. But there is no reason, you know, we're talking about a contract and there's no reason to be putting the instructions there about faculty to go to HR. I mean, that is something that university can convey that message to them. We are basically interested in letting them know what are their benefits. And so why put that language about HR in there?
Are you in agreement with everything else?
Everything else we're in agreement with. If you take out the thing about that they could go to HR because that they should be told when they come to orientation or whatever. But we are in agreement with everything else. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So then I think since we have 1 minute left and four people need to go, so then I think why don't we wait to hear from you guys if we can meet on the 17th. And otherwise we'll just have to
We're not meeting on the 17th.
Okay. So
December 1st is our next meeting.
Okay. All right. Okay.
She requested for you to see if there's any time on November 17th.
Right. But that was just to discuss 23, which I think so. Yeah, we don't have anything scheduled for the 17th. That's next week, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sherry, you're on mute. I can hear you talking through the wall.
Oh, December 17th is, yeah, that's Oh, that's unworkable for me. I've got several other things planned on that, some things I've got to attend on that day. So, yeah, that won't work for me.
Okay. All right. So, Talat. So she had to leave really quick. All right, then. John, do you have any final words?
Not at this time.
Okay, so then we'll meet again December 1st. And Talat will be in touch.
If all right.
In between. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.